From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning. This is Tuesday, August 25th, 2020. We have your show lined up for you today. We're going to review the recent Vermont primary and big discussion going on about spoiled ballots. Remember those confusing instructions about having to stick different pieces of paper into different envelopes and all that? I guess some folks didn't get it right, and their votes didn't count. And we're going to find out first from 7 Days reporter Kevin McCollum, who wrote about this in the most recent issue of that paper, about what might have happened. And then we are going to find out the version from Secretary of State Jim Condos, who is, of course, Vermont's top elections officer. And then later on in the program, very, very excited to say I've got three members of the special commission appointed to develop celebrations surrounding the 100th anniversary of national women's suffrage. Tomorrow actually marks the 100th anniversary of the effective date of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which said that women would have the right to vote in all 50 states, or then 48 states. And The celebrations are a little bit muted because of the COVID-19 crisis, but we're going to have a nice chat about that anniversary in the second hour of the program with three of the Vermont Commission members, and should be a lot of fun to delve into that history a little bit, which I mentioned on the radio last week. I have some of my own family ties, an ancestor who was very active in the suffrage movement. So. But let's start right in on this question of spoiled ballots. And I believe we have Kevin McCollum from 7 Days on the line. Kevin, thanks very much for joining me.
No problem. Good to be here, Dave.
And so talk to me a little bit about what you found as you reported the story. Something like 6,000 ballots were spoiled. How does that compare with past performance?
Yeah, that was 9 times higher than previous primaries in the state of Vermont. And, you know, we always knew that with so many more people voting by mail this primary, there might be a few more people who got a little confused by the process and how it was supposed to be done, but we really didn't think there'd be that many people who would screw it up. But they did, and so their votes didn't count. So that was disappointing to see.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if obviously it would have to be a statewide race for this 6,000 vote impact to be effective, but were there any statewide races that were settled by margins of 6,000 votes or less?
In terms of statewide race, you mean like governor and lieutenant governor? No, but there were certainly statewide races, like for the House of representatives or the Senate, that definitely were decided by that margin. Right now, we've got a runoff happening in Chittenden County Senate race, and I think that's only there were the last two candidates for that. One of those Senate seats was separated by only 45 votes. So, yeah, definitely there were races close enough that could have been decided if those 6,000 votes had been cast.
Well, of course, I mean, what I was saying is the 6,000 votes. I hope most of those errant votes were outside of one Vermont House district that was settled in a very close or maybe still unsettled,
right,
a very close election. But I'm wondering, has anybody counted up these spoiled ballots in the affected House district? I mean, if there were a 45-vote margin and 100 spoiled ballots, then we might be in trouble.
Yeah, right. Well, the recount is happening right now in the Chittenden County Senate district race. But as I recall, there were more than 1,000 spoiled ballots in the Chittenden County Senate race. So definitely that margin is something that could have affected races in the state.
Wow. That's where you get to, I think that's where it becomes troubling. If you think there's a problem with vote counting that actually could affect the outcome of an election, then you go, well, that's trouble. So,
yep.
Is there any sort of fixing it retroactively? If officials come up with any plan to maybe go back and look again at these spoiled ballots and see if any of them can be unspoiled and, you know, the voters' intent gleaned from them or something?
No, that's not really what's going on. So what they're mostly trying to do is learn from their mistakes and understand why people made the mistakes they made to pause the ballots to not be counted so that they can make sure that people understand the vote by mail process a little better for the general election, which, as we all know, is right around the corner, right? So, voting by mail is a different process than going into the polling booth and voting, and it's got more steps, as we know, right? And people have to be careful, and they are certainly hoping that people pay more attention, they read all the instructions, and they get some help from family members if they need them, and they do it properly so that the vote will be sent back to the clerk to be counted properly in the general.
Is there any possibility, though, of simplifying the process in the future? Especially, I think it's more of a problem in primary elections where you have to choose one party's ballot and then basically you're rejecting the other two, but you're not supposed to toss those ballots in your recycling pile, those rejected ballots. You're supposed to put them in a special envelope dedicated to them, and then put that envelope along with your voted ballot into a larger envelope. I mean, it is definitely a multi-step process where you need to follow instructions. I don't know, it's not really that hard for somebody who's paying attention and has their wits about them and so on, but some people, I guess, aren't paying attention or something. I'm not sure. It's kind of amazing that it was as high as 6,000 or so, but, is there any talk of saying, hey, in the future, we need to simplify this process, just have the person vote one ballot and get that into an envelope and back to the town or city clerk? Well, is that under discussion?
Yeah, I'm not sure that is what people are discussing, or that solution, rather. But definitely simplifying the process and making it as clear as possible is definitely something that that people are discussing. I spoke to one individual who, when he read an early version of the story that seemed to be sort of suggesting that people had, made mistakes, he got in touch with us and was like, hey, man, it's not just on the voter here. It ought to be on the vote administrators. It ought to be on the clerks. It ought to be on the system of how we vote in the state of Vermont and how we vote in primaries and how we vote by mail. That could be made easier. It could be made simpler so that people aren't as confused as they obviously were in this latest primary. And so he was suggesting that, there's a clearer set of instructions for voters. Like one of his good points was like, hey, you get this big envelope full of other envelopes and ballots, and then you have to read the instructions on the envelopes about how to fill out the ballots and insert them into the envelopes, and it's all over the place. And none of it's graphical, right? It's all just English, and it's all some of it's small type, and you have to kind of follow the breadcrumbs to figure out how to do it. And his point was, hey, why don't we just have a simpler, user-friendly system that's easier to understand, maybe for people who don't read English as well, read very well, want to read that much information, maybe just make it simpler. And I think the Secretary of State's office has said that they definitely intend to insert one of those explanation sheets in the upcoming general election mail-in ballot envelope to make sure people understand and can follow along a little more clearly.
Well, let's see if I think we have a caller, a listener checking in. Is it Ed from White River Junction?
Yes.
Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yes. What's going on?
Yeah, Ed O'Donnell. How are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm originally from Delaware, and I worked for Department of Elections for 10 years, running polling places. And I can tell you there is voter suppression. There are ways that politicians who run these elections can, engage in illegal activity. It's a real worry. It's a real problem.
Do you think that's what's happened in Vermont with these spoiled ballots?
I don't know. I'm not an expert on that. But I know that generically everybody should be very concerned about a lot of illegality to suppress votes and to change the dynamic of an election. And some of the things that veteran workers in the Department of Elections in Delaware told me, which I believe to be true, you know, during the off-season, dishonest people in the Department of Elections shutting down all a lot of Republican voting places and senior voting places. In other words, there's a methodology. So we have to be on guard about this. It's a very serious problem.
Yeah, who do you think ought to do that? I mean, who should police the system if we need to be on guard?
Well, I think secretaries of state and the media and everybody. But I don't, you know, the law is that the election is the first Tuesday in November. I think early voting is unconstitutional. I don't see how anybody can justify that.
Well, interesting perspective.
But anyway, Google me. I'm third-party candidate for President of the United States. Google Ed O'Donnell, candidate for President of the United States. I've run in the New Hampshire primary for 35 years.
Awesome. Thanks for the call, Ed.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Kevin McCollum, I wanted to just sort of get your thoughts about do you have any inkling that there would be any intention or nefarious thinking behind this phenomenon of all these spoiled ballots in Vermont, or was this just sort of a kind of a shakedown cruise on the new system and one which may need a little tinkering?
Yeah, no, I have no indication that there's anybody trying to disenfranchise voters by making the process as difficult as possible. In fact, I think it's just the opposite. I think the Secretary of State's office is trying to get as many people in the state of Vermont to be able to feel comfortable voting and by whatever means necessary, and that voting by mail was the way that they felt would be most comfortable for most voters in a pandemic. And so they, in the primary, urged them to participate by absentee ballot. And then in the general election, obviously they're going to actually go one step further and physically mail everybody a ballot, whether they ask for one or not. So, I mean, I think it's hard to argue that is anyone structurally trying to disenfranchise voters. But I think you can certainly make the case that they don't make it as simple as as they could. But it's also important to remember that the simplicity that people would desire is also maybe at odds with some of the security measures to make sure that vote is actually from the person who they say it's from. So, you know, we can't on one hand, scream about the injustice of having the process be as complicated as it is, and yet on the other hand, you know, cry or scream or worry about how fraudulent and absentee balloting is, or voting by mail is. Many of the measures that make the mail-in balloting process a multi-step process are there because they're trying to make sure that the vote is from the person who says it's their vote. So that's all the procedures about signing the outside of the envelope that has your ballot on it and returning that ballot, and then even, as you mentioned, Dave, not just throwing out the ballots that you don't vote, but actually having to mail them back to the clerk in a different envelope, actually turned out to be one of the things that people screwed up the most, right? And that's an effort to eliminate concern about unvoted ballots floating around in the world, right? So, it's important to remember that this is a primary where it's an open primary where you can vote for any party that you want to, but you can't vote for multiple parties, right? You can't decide you're going to vote in the Republican primary and then you're also going to vote, you're going to vote for Phil Scott in the Republican primary, but then you're also going to grab the Democratic ballot and vote for, you know, David Zuckerman in the Democratic primary. That's not how it works. You have to pick one. You can pick whichever one you want, but you got to pick one. And so the system requires you to send back the ones that you don't vote, and that is one of the things that people apparently messed up.
I was going to ask, were a lot of the spoiled ballots basically cases of attempted cross voting? I know a lot of Vermonters. You know, just by the calls I get on the show here when the subject comes up, they say, you know, why can't I vote for Phil Scott and you know in the Republican primary and Molly Gray in the Democratic primary or whatever, you know, and how come I can't? I should be free to do that. It's my right or whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I've ever really come up with the best explanation of, one that will satisfy a lot of the listeners who raised this question as to why that's the case. I know I put the question to Jim Condos, the Secretary of State, more than once, and maybe I'll try it again today and see if he can articulate some reasoning that will make voters say, oh, okay, I see that. So that's why. Okay, yeah, I get it now. I'm just wondering if anybody, in terms of steps that might be taken to simplify this in the future, what about the idea of, already we have this two-step process where people got a postcard in the mail, mm-hmm. and you basically sent the postcard back in requesting a ballot for primary day.
Right.
And maybe that post at the postcard sending back step of the process, that's where you could ask for which ballot you want. You could say, send me the Republican ballot, or send me the progressive ballot, or send me the Democratic ballot. And then at least you wouldn't have this confusing mess on your kitchen table when you're trying to vote. You know, I mean, just yep. one that could be one approach. I don't know, but
that's an interesting idea. I mean, I think you'd also get people though who hadn't yet drilled down on who they wanted to vote for. And then by the time they did, and they found that they only had the one ballot that they requested, and then they changed their mind, and then they'd have to request again. So, I mean, it's important to remember that in other states, primaries are conducted by the people who have registered in that state as a member of a party, right? You register as a Democrat or as a Republican in many states, and you don't get to participate in the primaries of those other parties at all. And so that's the people who get confused on this, maybe it's good to remind them of that this is an open primary that gives Vermonters more choices than many other states do, but that going so far as to allow them to vote in multiple primaries starts to get into ground that becomes problematic, and I'm not qualified necessarily to explain all the problems that might create to allow people to vote in multiple primaries at once, but I think it's many.
Well, it's interesting that we have Secretary of State Jim Condos coming on in the second half hour this morning. Maybe he can tackle some of these questions. I hope he's listening now and thinking about, oh yeah, I got one for that one.
Yeah, well, we obviously spoke to him for the story, and he did express a concern that the number of spoiled ballots, defective ballots, was as high as it was, and he does say that they're taking several steps to try to make sure the issue is in terms of education of voters and simplification of the process. So one point he will make, I'm sure, when you ask him about this, is he'll point out that, you know, look, there's only one ballot in the November election. They are not going to have this situation of three different ballots, needing to pick one, needing to vote that one in a very specific way, and then return the other two unvoted ballots in a very specific way and return the whole shooting match back to your clerk, in perfect order. It's just one ballot mailed to you. You vote the ballot, mail it back, and you're done. So his point is, hey, yeah, it's concerning. We'd never like to see votes not counted. The general election is going to be a much simpler process, so he'll guarantee that the defective rate is going to be lower, and that they're going to take steps to try to clarify the process for folks.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I was just going to get to that. In fact, I think you're right that just by the nature of the beast, a general election, even in the days before mail-in voting was a big thing, was a lot simpler than a primary because, you know, historically, if you were going to the polls on primary day, you still had to choose that one party's ballot and you weren't allowed to vote on the other party ballots. And so the basic framework of the thing has not changed. It's just I think a lot of people probably were a little freaked out when they saw all that random paper on their, you know, on their table or desk or whatever when they were trying to vote. And where do I put this thing? What am I doing here? And then the phone rings, you get distracted or, you know, whatever.
And that's the other important thing to remember is that you're exactly right. There are people who were doing this for the first time this year. That's the other thing that the explanation for the sharp increase in defective ballots is you've got all these people who've made it a habit in their lives to go to the polls and to participate in primaries that way. And this year they got all this messaging about don't go to the polls, right? Don't do that. Vote by mail. And so people who might have done the in-person voting did it this way for the first time because they were asked to. And, you know, and there were probably people who don't even really vote in – there definitely were people who don't even really vote in primaries that much because they're not super engaged on that level who got all this messaging, who got the card that said, hey, vote by mail this year. So they're like, okay, I'll vote by mail this year. But it's not even something they would normally bother to do in a primary because they didn't feel strongly about the candidates at that stage. And so they got sucked into the process, but they got swept into the process, let's say, of participating in the primary, which is good because it's more participation, but that their experience with primaries is limited or lower, less than it might be otherwise, let's say.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I guess maybe a lesson is, hey, folks, voting in primaries takes practice.
Yeah.
You've got to have to have been at it for a while in order to be assured of a smooth performance. But, I mean, on the other hand, I do hope some thought is being given by the Secretary of State's office and the clerks, the folks working on how to design this thing. Are there any steps we could take to simplify it and just cut down on the I mean, part of it's the cost of postage, but I mean, if there were a way to cut down on the paperwork, it might make it less prone to errors. You know, and to me, it does remind me. I've mentioned this, I think, you before, Kevin. But sometimes when you're dealing with state government at any level, you do wonder about all the many steps that seem really a lot friendlier to the state officials who are going to be working their end of the process, as opposed to being friendly to the beleaguered members of the public out there trying to squeeze in some voting between work and washing the dishes or whatever. You know, and it reminds me a little bit of a comment my wife made when we got a envelope from the Department of Motor Vehicles last year sometime, I think, and she looked at it and you had to read all this little fine print to figure out how to open the darn thing. Yeah. Her comment was, you shouldn't have to read instructions to open an envelope.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent point. And you know, again, it gets back to this question of why, right? If you can, in order to fix a problem, you have to understand how the problem got to be like it is, right?
I think
if you recognize that, the steps are all there because someone has identified a risk that taking that step will get over that risk and resolve that risk, then it's easier to understand. But yet I also go back to the point that the gentleman in my story made about it could be simpler. It could be as simple as having larger font sizes on the envelopes. You don't have to read, you know, 10-point type. It could be simple things like color coding. It could be simple things like arrows that say sign here with big red arrows, you know, to make people, you know, because one of the other things people didn't do is they didn't sign the envelope. They take their ballot, they vote it, put it in the envelope, send it off. It's like, well, wait a minute. You didn't sign your name on the back of the envelope in the specific way that was asked to. So you didn't, you know, and so like if there were more steps, like if private industry were running, you know, a primary, and their goal was to make sure that the maximum possible rate of ballots were voted properly. You know, there'd be all kinds of technologies and ideas and graphics and logos and color coding to make sure that as many people as possible voted properly. But you don't see that in this process, and you wonder why. And so I have some of those same questions.
Yeah, of course, if we're a private industry that also have 40 pages of really, really fine print, and then one little box to check that just says "I agree."
Yeah, right.
But, so there are
that was definitely not a suggestion on my part that that's the direction we ought to go. But but some thought ought to go into making it more user friendly for sure.
Yeah, that is well, I guess the process here is always to try to work on a more perfect union, and maybe it'll be slightly closer to perfect next time. Who knows? But let's hope.
That's for sure.
Kevin McCollum has been my guest in the first half hour of the Dave Graham Show. Really appreciate you joining me this morning, Kevin, and thank you very much for your insights on all this.
You got it.
All righty. Hey, we are heading into a bottom-of-the-hour break for some CBS News on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And don't forget, later on after the show today, we're going to be hearing from Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials in their regular Tuesday and Friday COVID-19 update press conference. So stay tuned for that on WDEV. And stay tuned here for our show to continue after this bottom-of-the-hour break for some CBS News.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry. Puzzles and toys for all ages. Art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, entering into the second half hour, I should say, of our program on this Tuesday morning, August the 25th. And we are going to be talking in this segment of the show with Secretary of State Jim Condos. We've got all sorts of questions to ask about this huge pile of spoiled ballots that turned up in the primary voting of a couple of weeks ago. I believe Jim Condos is on the line with us this morning. Mr. Secretary, good morning, and thank you for joining us. And do we have Jim Condos with us? I didn't hear any response. Oh, well, okay. Yeah, had Kevin McCollum on that first half hour from 7 days, and he wrote a story about this issue in the most recent edition of the paper, in which he was talking about basically something like 6,000 and change ballots were deemed spoiled in the primary. Of course, this was a new tour, a new trip for many, many Vermonters, not to the polling place, but to the mailbox, with a rather complicated arrangement of envelopes in which you had to had to pick the ballot, put it back in the right envelope, and get it mailed off, put the ballots you didn't vote in another envelope, and et cetera. We'll talk to Jim Condos. I believe we've now got him back with us. Good morning, Mr. Secretary.
Good morning. Technical issues, I guess.
Yeah, something like that. Hey, so I wanted to just check in with you because we haven't spoken since the primary. We spoke on primary day, I think, last, and the ballot counting ended up with 6,000 and change spoiled ballots statewide, I understand, and that's about nine times the historic levels of such things in Vermont primaries. What did you make of that?
Well, obviously it's a concern, Dave, but you mentioned nine times. I'd rather put it in the percentage. It was 3.5%. Of the overall vote. Typically we find we're less 1% or less. And however, I will also say that we believe that the primary is also a higher defective rate because of the complexity of the fact that we send three ballots. That's state law. That's been in effect for years, for decades, where three ballots get sent out, the major party ballots are sent out. Keep in mind, the primary, which usually only gets 20 to 25% max of the voter checklist for turnout, usually, the primary is about a party nomination process, and it is not about, it's not the same as the general election. In essence, we're running three separate elections on primary day. We run a Democratic primary, a Republican primary, and a progressive primary.
Would it be easier if they were run on, say, successive Tuesdays or something? You know, just go, I don't know, take them alphabetically, Democratic on the 11th of August, and then Republican on the, or progressive, I guess, would be next alphabetically on the 18th of August, et cetera. Would that make it any easier?
We would have to back it up the other way. We couldn't go any closer towards the general election. As it is, we're crunched for time. We have a recount that's going on it doesn't start till tomorrow, and it'll probably take a week to a week and a half to complete by the time we get the judge's order. And then we have to immediately send, we have 275 different ballots that we have to create for the general election. The general election will be much simpler. It's only one ballot. It will go out and people vote and then send it back or drop it off at their clerk or whatever. So we expect that the number of defective ballots for the general to be much less. I think a lot of what we saw this year in the primary is most likely that we had a tremendous number of first-time voters in the primary. Let's be clear. The record before this was 122,000 in the year 2000. And then in 2016, we had 120,000, and in 2018, we had 107,000 that voted in the primary. This year, we had 174,000 ballots that were voted one way or the other. And so I think, you know, we had a tremendous increase, no question. That's gratifying that we had such an increase, at least gratifying for me, maybe not for some of the folks, but for me. Because what I'm interested in is trying to increase voter turnout. I also I'm not happy about the fact that we had some defective ballots, an increase of defective ballots, and we're gonna revamp or look at these. We're gonna be meeting with the town clerk. We're gonna be meeting with the legislative committees to decide what to do before the next primary, which comes up 2 years from now. There's not a lot of options. One of the things might be to do away with the requirement of sending back the ballots that you don't vote. But here's the three items, the biggest three reasons why ballots became defective. One, they didn't sign the certificate envelope. Two, that they voted more than one ballot. And three, that they didn't send back the two unvoted ballots. Those were the three main reasons why ballots were deemed defective. And I heard your previous guest talking about, making it clear. Well, if you look at the certificate envelope, it was on the front side and two places two places on the front side, one place on the back side. It said you must put your ballot in this envelope and sign it.
Yeah. And in some cases that didn't happen. I was just sort of thinking on the fly in the first half hour about steps might be taken to simplify this process and make it easier for people who really hate reading instructions. Remember, you know, there's been a lot of cartoons and probably comedy scripts on TV and stuff about it, especially guys for some reason. I'm a guy, so I can disparage my own people. Who don't like to read instructions. You know, you get the new piece of furniture or something, you well, I can put this thing together, I don't have to read that booklet. And then 3 hours later, you're reading the booklet. But so maybe there's some of that going on. What about this is a two-step process where you send out a postcard saying, are you alive? Can you please send us back a postcard and raise your hand saying you want a ballot, basically? And then you get the ballot, and that starts the whole actual voting process. Suppose you, in that first go-round, you said to the voter, by the way, since you're asking for a ballot, you have a chance right now. You don't have to, but you have a chance right now to select which party's ballot you want. And then that voter gets, you know, already knows he or she, I'm going to vote Democrat, and therefore send me the Democratic ballot, or I'm going to vote Republican or whatever. and right there, you end up with a skinnier envelope, less postage for your the folks who are sending it to you, and a skinnier envelope and a simpler process when you get to take all the pieces of paper out of that envelope. Would that work?
No. And there's a reason why. The people would not be happy with that because, first of all, we do not have party registration in this state. Party registration, frankly, if we had party registration, that would solve the problem. That means that if Dave Graham is registered as a independent, you can't vote in any of the primaries. If Dave Graham is registered as a Republican, he would only be allowed to vote in the Republican primary.
Right.
And so that's one way to go. And there have been some folks who have called for that. But back in the late 70s, early 80s, there was extensive debate by the legislature. I think they had public hearings. I wasn't actually involved back then. But they talked about it, and Vermonters overwhelmingly did not want party registration. They wanted to maintain their independent streak, and they did not want party registration. The biggest question we get for the presidential primary, which is the only primary every 4 years, where you have to ask for one or the other, and we do that for absentee as well. You have to declare which one you want. It doesn't necessarily mean that's the party that you belong to or that you support, but it just says that this is the ballot you want. We get more angry calls and emails about why I have to pick a party. I don't want anyone to know what party I support or whatever. And we could not, we either have to do it whole hog or we would have to, we couldn't do it part way. We couldn't say, okay, for those that don't know, we'll send you three, and for those that do, we'll send you one. That would be a nightmare for the town clerks to keep track of going forward. So I just think we have to have the debate. We have to have this discussion. We will. And see about ways that we can improve this process. I certainly support looking at it. I'm never, you know, coming as someone who comes from the private sector. I had over 30 years of experience, you know, with a Fortune 100 company, a regulated utility, and a $100 million family-owned business here in Vermont. I can honestly say that there are many different things that we have to do. We also have to consider costs. We're printing envelopes that, you know, 450,000 envelopes, and if you start adding color to it, that adds another cost on top of that. So we have, you know, I will tell you that the other issue, I think, Dave, that may have happened, we don't know for sure, but the town clerks are supposed to put in what we call a butt slip, which is it's a printer's term, meaning an instruction sheet, a simplified instruction sheet. There is already the one that's on the ballot envelope, but they're supposed to also put a simplified, concise, clear instruction sheet in there. Now, I know that my ballot did not arrive with a sheet. It was just what was on the ballot envelope itself. And I can't tell you how many others do that, but those absentee ballots were sent out by the individual clerks to all the different people who requested them. For this general election, we are sending those centrally, and we will, every ballot envelope will have a clear, concise set of instructions included in it. So we're taking that step ahead of time. That's the one thing that I can say that, you know, we have learned that from that aspect of it, but, it hasn't been as big a problem in the past. This time, I think there was a lot of, as I said, first time voters, and for the primary, and the primary can be confusing.
Let's see. I know what we need to do. We need to take a call. Jim from Barrie's on the line. He's been waiting patiently. Good morning, Jim.
Hi, good morning. I just tuned in, so I apologize if you already addressed this. But I had heard, and I can't even tell you if it was in Vermont or not, but you're going to print a barcode on the envelope and the ballot, the envelope that was originally sent out, so that you can cross-reference the ballot to the name to make sure there's only one ballot coming from that person. Is that accurate? Is that true? And if it is, doesn't that threaten the secrecy of the ballot?
Well, first of all, it's only going to be on, it's not on the ballot. There's nothing on the ballot to identify who voted that ballot. In fact, if, and we've had this happen before, where someone will print their name or sign the ballot. When that happens, that's a defective ballot because it violates the sanctity of privacy. What we are doing with the certificate envelope, which you already have to print your name and you already have to sign, is on the on the back side, we're going to have the name and the voter ID number from our system and a barcode put on that outside of that envelope. So that the clerks, when they process them, they'll just be able to process them very quickly using most of the clerks. In fact, I think all the clerks have a wand. I don't know if they all use it or not, but they all have a barcode reader wand that they can use to update their participation reports. So the ballot itself will still be private. There will be no way that anybody can know unless they open the envelope and look at it and match it up and say, well, Joe Smith voted for so-and-so. But that isn't supposed to happen. That's why you have two people opening those ballots. One person opens the ballot, takes the ballot out upside down, and hands it to the next person who either deposits it in the ballot box, a secure ballot box, so that they get all intermingled. Yeah, this is really no different than signing it, but you still have to sign it.
But so the barcode's only on one of the items then. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate it. One thing I'm wondering about this, Jim Condos, is if I get curious, I mean, I sort of, you know, one of these middle-of-the-night moments is like, holy cow, did I do it right? You know, is there any way to check that? Can I call my city clerk and say, hey, was my vote recorded?
Actually, you can find out if your ballot was deemed defective or not, or if it was processed by going to the My Voter page on our elections website. The My Voter page is the unique web page for each and every registered voter in the state of Vermont. We have on that page is your address, where you vote, what your poll location is, who your town clerk is. You can get a sample ballot. You can request your early vote ballot. All these different things that are there. And there's also a tracking mechanism, which a lot of people just learned really about. But there is a tracking mechanism that will tell you when the town clerk received your order for an early ballot, when he or she sent it out, when they received it back, and then its status.
Hmm. That's really interesting. I mean, I guess that's one thing that I would. Well, actually, coming up to the general election, there's all these concerns about the post office and so on, and slow mail, and so somebody, let's say, sends in a mail-in ballot on, you know, October 25th for the November 3rd election, and wants to know, is it there? Did it get counted, et cetera? And maybe even on November 3rd wants to know, is it there? Did it get counted? Because if not, then I'm going to physically take myself down to the polls. I'm going to mask up and get ready for standing 6 feet apart from everybody, but got to do this. That kind of thing. Could you end up handling it that way if the mail didn't get your ballot back to your clerk in time?
That, well, that's one of the reasons why we have that, is so that people can check to see. And, you know, the issue is, if your ballot is deemed defective, there's no recourse at that point. You are mm-hmm. done for that election. You can't, there's no redo. You can't call up your clerk and say, hey, I think I forgot to sign it. And they say, yes, you did. Come on down. They don't do that, because it just is, it would just consume their time unbelievably. It would be an administrative nightmare to keep those ballots. I have to sort through the ballots, and you can imagine, like this time, you know, the number of ballots that we had over 150,000 requests went out for early ballots, and to try to keep those by town in the alphabetical order would be a monstrous undertaking, so that they could find them. But it is, you know, we're constantly looking at how we can improve the situation. I'll never say never. I always have an optimistic look that we can figure something else out. And I think it's just a, you know, we're trying to provide the tools. The system we have in place now didn't go into place until the fall of 2015, and we've improved it even since then. So, you know, keep in mind, prior to 2014, we didn't even have online campaign finance or online lobbying disclosure. And you must remember those days, Dave, where you used to yep. sit in our office waiting for the last reports to come in. And I think, yep. So now we've drastically improved that situation. The same thing goes with our election management. In fact, when I first took office, which was 2011, and after the 2012 election, which was my first general election, we were 38th in the nation in the state ranking by the MIT, what's called EPI Index, which is an election performance index. We were 38th in 2012. After the 14 election, we had moved up to 16. And then after we had put in our new system, we had moved up to number one. And we just barely got the new ranking for 2018. It usually takes about a year and a half for those rankings to come out. And we had dropped just slightly to number three from the number one position. And I believe both of the states in front of us were states that had put new systems in place in the meantime. So we're constantly looking at how we can improve. It is really something that is near and dear to my heart to stay in that top tier of states as far as election performance.
Let's bring in Ruth from Sheldon. She's been waiting on the line. Ruth, it's got to be really quick, though, because we're almost out of time. So go ahead.
Yes. Well, I had wanted to call when your first guest was on to thank him for 7 days for reporting on this story, because I think it's incredibly important. I think it's terrible that over 6,000 people lost their vote. And I blame, I do think the Secretary of State is responsible for this, and I hold him accountable. And now he's on. Are you going to use the same list to send out the general election ballots? Because I got multiple ballots of people who don't live with us.
First of all,
I called your office.
Let's let Jim Condos reply, Ruth.
Hold on. Huh?
Ruth, you only have seconds to go. Let's let Jim Condos reply. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you.
First off, what we sent out in before the primary was actually postcards, and those postcards were also forwardable postcards. They were also designed not only to help people request a ballot, but it was also designed to help the clerks clean up their checklist. So that was one thing. For the general election, we're using an updated list, which will be pulled next week and sent to the mailhouse.
Got to wrap it up, Jim. I'm really sorry to interrupt, but thank you very much for being my guest, and let's talk about this again soon. Jim Condos, Secretary of State of Vermont. Top of the hour news. We'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow.
you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren store. Practicing all safe protocols, masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Hey, thanks for staying with us into our second hour of this program on Tuesday, August the 25th. And I believe we have one of our CBS News correspondents with us, Peter Mayer, joins us. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
And I saw on the list that I get from CBS News every morning, this morning's version had you as someone who could tell us all about the Republican National Convention's opening night last night. What were your chief takeaways?
Well, I guess we could say welcome to the Donald Trump Show, a Donald J. Trump production. Rarely or never has a candidate played such a direct hands-on role in the production of a party convention, Dave, and I started covering them back in 1980. You know, traditionally, party nominees speak just on the last night of the convention. The rest of the week is meant to be a build-up to the acceptance speech, but as we know, Mr. Trump is not a traditional candidate. He's not a traditional president, for that matter, and so he's going to be part of the program every day, as we saw yesterday.
Yeah, I'm sure that is quite popular among his folks. I mean, and the party is, I'm sure, quite excited about the fact that the leader has been kind enough to visit with the group all 4 days. And tell us a little bit about the tone and the sort of overall presentation. What are the main pitches that the Republican Party is making and that President Trump is making as well?
Well, the main pitch is they don't have a party platform this year, which, again, breaks with tradition. I can't ever remember a convention where there wasn't a party platform. You know, normally they have party hearings and discussions about what they want. Various factions work really hard and fight to get their ideals and their issues in the platform. This year, the platform basically comes down to one thing, reelect Donald Trump. As for the tone, the president and a lot of the people around him said, hey, watch this convention because it's going to be positive and uplifting, his words. Last night, it was not exactly positive and uplifting. You had Kimberly Guilfoyle, the former Fox News personality, who, by the way, is dating Don Trump Jr., speaking at an empty auditorium in D.C. near the White House, the Mellon Auditorium, and screaming like there were, you know, thousands of people there, but it was an empty auditorium because of the COVID crisis, and warning that Democrats want to destroy the country and everything we fought for and hold dear. She said, quote, they want to steal your liberty, your freedom. They want to control what you see and think and believe so they can control how you live. That's the basic tone of what, to answer your question, we heard last night.
Yeah, there was another moment where I think the couple from St. Louis, the McCloskeys, who were brandished, well, demonstrators walked by a couple of months ago, were speakers last night, and I think they were the ones who raised the issue of we were going to destroy the suburbs.
That's
your
right.
Suburban lifestyle would be gone. And I think it's worth pointing out, you know, the history of this, that we have had Democratic presidents, certainly Bill Clinton during the 1990s, Barack Obama for the 8 years previous to President Trump. Somehow the suburbs all pretty much survived those eras, right?
Yeah, you know, look, this is a racial appeal. There's no other way about it. The speech largely focused on scaring suburban voters. This is, you know, a major voting block in the upcoming election. And as we saw in the midterms, the voters there helped Democrats flip congressional districts in the 2018 midterms. You know, they said last night, the McCloskeys, the radicals are not content just marching in the streets. They want to walk the halls of Congress. They want power. This is Joe Biden's party. So, you know, this was a controversial choice, but a choice that obviously the Trump people felt would appeal to their base, the McCloskeys, Mark and Patricia McCloskey.
And one thing I wonder about the Trump base is what folks are there are making of the president's stance on the conduct of the upcoming election. He's made some remarks about this just in the past day or so, in which, I mean, it seems like almost a heads I win, tails you lose situation in which the president is essentially saying, if I win, I win. If I lose, you cheated. There's no way this president can legitimately lose the election. Am I reading that accurately?
Yeah, I think so, Dave. You know, he's making these unfounded claims that the Democrats are trying to rig the election by, making the issue of mail-in ballots. That's the term I was looking for. And, it's just simply not the case, but he is raising this issue repeatedly, and I'm sure he will again in his acceptance speech on Thursday night, which brings me to the other break with tradition, and that's using the White House as a prop in a political sense, which really has not been done, or I should say rarely been done. FDR spoke in a political fashion from the Oval Office. I believe it was the announcing his third term. Jimmy Carter recorded a commercial in the White House. But, you know, other than that, we've never seen, you know, just the blatant use of the White House as a platform. Last night, the president spoke from first the East Room under the George Washington portrait, then the Diplomatic Room under another portrait, and he's going to speak from a huge stage that's being constructed on the South Lawn of the White House when he gives his acceptance speech. His wife is going to speak from the newly renovated White House Rose Garden tonight. That in itself is controversial here in Washington because it has been so drastically redesigned, and a number of people are up in arms about that.
Well, full employment for D.C. area gardeners, maybe? I don't know.
But we're talking. Yeah.
Yep. We're talking about breaks with tradition. In this case, the use of the White House is actually a break with the law, isn't it?
Well, you know, there is the Hatch Act, which says that, people who work for administrations cannot use government property for political purposes. And there's a gray area about whether this applies to presidents. It certainly applies to all the other people who work in the White House. You know, I have to tell you, first of all, I want to make clear, I am a retired correspondent, so I am now able to give my opinion and my personal opinion. I covered the White House from Jimmy Carter through Barack Obama. I became something of a purist about the dignity and the propriety of the presidency and of the White House itself. I don't want to sound like, you know, holier than thou, goody two-shoes, Dave, but I just don't think that the White House should be used as, again, a political prop, a political stage. That's not, it symbolizes the office of the presidency and not the person who happens to be living there at the time. More than one president referred to it as the People's House. This president seems to refer to it as the Trump House.
Yep. All right. Well, maybe there won't be giant letters TRUMP implanted on the building anytime in the near future, or who knows? We break with tradition these days. Peter Mayer, thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's great talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
All right, Dave. Great to be with you, and congratulations on what your station has done and is doing for Vermont. I think it's just marvelous.
Well, thanks very much. Peter Mayer of CBS News, emeritus, I guess. First time appearance for him on our show with me as the host anyway, and really appreciate his kind words there. Wednesday, August the 26th is the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage taking effect in the United States of America, meaning that women had the right to vote in all 50 states, or actually 48 states back then. Obviously, it continued after Alaska and Hawaii were later added to the Union for those states. And we are really happy to have three folks who have been very close to this issue in Vermont over recent months. So we have three members, actually, of the Vermont Suffrage Centennial Alliance. This is a special group created to observe the 100th anniversary of women gaining the right to vote. I'm going to inject a little editorial comment here right at the top of the conversation and say, I still find it unbelievable that for the first almost 150 years of this country's history, women did not have the right to vote. It kind of makes me slap my forehead and go, what is up with that? But anyway, maybe we can get some answers from our distinguished guests here this morning. Sue Racanelli is director of the Vermont Suffrage Centennial Alliance and also president of the League of Women Voters of Vermont. Sue, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Dave.
Tabitha Moore is Tabitha Moore is president of the NAACP Rutland branch and is also a member of the Alliance. Tabitha, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Rachel Onuf, I didn't get to check that pronunciation. How do you pronounce O-N-U-F, Rachel?
You did it perfectly. Thanks, Dave.
Excellent. Good guess. I said Onuf? Onuf?
I get enough sometimes. And, yeah, I'll answer to any.
All right. Rachel Onuf is the Vermont Historical Records Program Director and well-versed in Vermont suffrage history and has a really interesting project that she's working on. And since I brought it up already, I'm going to ask you, Rachel, to bat first here. What's the really interesting project you're working on?
Well, part of the Vermont Historical Records Program that I direct, which is based at the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration, is to really try to engage citizens of Vermont in research, in history, in telling the stories of our state. So one of our civic engagement projects, in light of it being the centennial, was to start to see how many women's stories we could unearth who were active in the movement, but also just simply who might have voted, and to try to find out more about those people. And it's been a learning curve for me, because I naively thought that there would be checklists that would show us the names of every woman who actually voted. And it turns out the closest we can get is to know, and this is thanks to the Secretary of State keeping records about these tallies, is that there were 28,159 women registered to vote by the official count kept by the Secretary of State in 1920. And just to keep that in perspective, that was compared to 87,768 men. Hmm. So the idea is to get folks to, is to crowdsource and to get people working in their communities to try to find out more about the women who were registered. And town records can help. Some towns would keep track in the record book that's kept by the town clerk's office of who had taken the Freeman's Oath. And if you were administered the oath, you were able to vote. So that's kind of the indicator of whether they were able to be prepared to vote, whether or not they actually exercised that right. And it ranges from town to town. And again, the Secretary of State's tallies break it down by town. So we can see that there were four women in Verchere who were registered compared to, 35 in Arlington, so we can look at the stats and know what to look for. So that's been the project. And just through several people got records from the Vergennes Historical Society, who'd gone in and found some of the 278 women, I believe, were registered there. And just, again, starting with kind of finding the names, just staking the name. And then if you can start to tell the story and find out more about them. And I encourage people to do this as we went into the pandemic, because a lot of records are available online, like the federal census from 1920, freely available. You can research Vermont newspapers, thanks to an agreement the State Archives set up with newspapers.com for free. You have to set up an account with myvermont.gov, but then you have access to millions of pages of state newspapers and can get into the real nitty-gritty of people's lives that way. So encouraging people to get into it in whatever way speaks to them, to try to find out more about, and maybe it's an ancestor, in this proclamation in recognition of Women's Equality Day, which is tomorrow, Governor Scott made mention of his grandmother in Plainfield, who probably registered to vote. You know, it'd be wonderful to kind of have him move a little bit forward. You know, can he figure that out for sure? Do a little historical research. I'd love to help him. So yeah, there's a lot of ways in to finding out more about individual women.
Governor, there's an offer of help. So reach out to Rachel if you're listening.
Yeah.
And but this is really fascinating to me because I was reading a little bit on this topic and noted that it was Tennessee that actually was the last state in which vote of the legislature and signature of the governor clinched the passage of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That occurred, I believe, on August the 18th, 1920, and then it was on August 26th. That Secretary of State and Federal Secretary of State Bainbridge Colby signed the paperwork to confirm that, yes, indeed, this constitutional amendment was now appended to the Constitution. The and Vermont at the time was holding off. I guess Governor Percival Clement here in Montpelier was an opponent to women's suffrage. And so Vermont was a little bit of a laggard and didn't show up to the parade until 1921. Have I got that right?
That's right. February 8th, 1921, Vermont finally ratified the amendment, which had been ratified at the federal level the summer before.
Mm-hmm.
Governor Clement was not in favor. The legislature had passed a presidential suffrage bill in March of 1919, but he vetoed that. And then he refused in the next year to allow a special session of the legislature to convene, citing, too much expense and other reasons why it wasn't feasible to bring the legislature together for a special session to ratify the federal amendment. And at that point, the Vermont Equal Suffrage Association was trying a full court press, and it's fascinating to look at the records. They had a press secretary, Lillian Oldendam, who set up at a hotel in Burlington and was just firing out missives left and right to editors of the papers, influential men in all manner of lines of business, and of course politicians, trying to ensure that she would have their support if a special session was called. Both, would they be in favor of a special session, and then would they then of course vote in favor of women being able to vote for the president? So a lot of savvy work at the end there to try to get public opinion behind them and sway the governor, but ultimately unsuccessful. Even a march in miserable weather in April 1920 of 400 women on Montpelier to protest Clement did not move the man.
It's kind of amazing when you think about the similarities between those days and this. We've seen plenty of parades down State Street in rather inclement weather or freezing cold weather sometimes or whatever in modern times. We of course have seen the legislature take on a variety of issues occasionally slightly more progressive stances on things than the governor. And the more things change, I guess they say, right? Let's bring in Sue Racanelli. Sue, the Vermont Suffrage Centennial Alliance had set up a whole variety of activities and celebrations, et cetera, surrounding the 100th anniversary. A lot of it, I guess, curtailed by the coronavirus crisis, like everybody else's stuff has been curtailed. Tell us a little bit about what is going on.
Well, the Vermont Suffrage Centennial Alliance is a group of about 60 organizations and 20 individuals that got together in 2018 because we wanted to commemorate the centennial of the 19th Amendment, where women got the right to vote. A highlight event was supposed to be a parade that had to happen last Saturday, but of course the coronavirus took over, and we are now postponing it for 2021. In the meantime, we have gone virtual with quite a few of our events. We just recently had a very successful suffrage scramble 5K run and walking for people. We had over 411 people participating, and we had people as far as Australia and Guam also taking part in it. Our oldest participant in the scramble was 92 years old, and our youngest was 2 years old. So this was a very successful event that we put together with the Central Vermont Runners Association. And we also have had a symposium with the Ethan Allen Historical Museum. And we've just got a lot of things going on in the future. We are planning to have a play, the Suffrage Reenactment Society, that was supposed to be in the fall, but will now move into 2021 as well. And in October, we are having Sally Roche Wagner, a historian, reputable historian from New York, coming in to do a virtual presentation to high schools and universities in Vermont.
Well, that'll be really interesting, and I'm sure it will open a lot of eyes to the thinking that went into this push for women's suffrage. And Tabitha Moore, let me ask you your thoughts about this question. What explains an absence of voting rights for women in the first nearly century and a half of our country's history?
Well, I think it's the same thing that is behind what we're seeing. I don't know if you've been watching the news in the last 2 days. Two more black men were gunned down by police, one in Lafayette, Trey Ford Pellerin, who was actually murdered, and then another gentleman who's currently in critical condition. The issue is that there are people who do not want us people in minority positions to have the right. When you mentioned the governor who wanted to delay women's right to vote in Vermont, it was because of his own greed related to prohibition. He thought that if women voted, they would vote against prohibition. So when you look at, you know, the centuries in this country and what it comes down to in terms of delaying people basic human rights, it always comes down to someone's fear of loss of their own control and their own power.
Yeah, that seems to be a theme, and one which needs to be resisted and changed over time, we hope. I mean, do you see signs of evolution on this? You think all the way back kind of in the course of Western history to the Magna Carta in 1215,
right,
when you know, power devolved from the king to the nobles, and then late 18th century, all of a sudden a greater number of white male property owners are allowed to vote. And then more people come to the table when women get the right to vote in 1920. It took till 1965 to get the Voting Rights Act passed and allow people of racial minorities to have their voting rights protected. It does seem to be an expanding universe of participation, doesn't it, we hope?
You know, I want to have hope, and at the same time, I also need to be realistic about the fact that progress only moves at the pace of the majority, not at the pace of human need and human suffering, which is what we've seen time and time again. When you look at the 15th Amendment, for example, that guaranteed, or at least gave the promise or the hope that black men could vote, black women were left out, and all other races, again, were left out. Then the 19th Amendment, again, black women were not celebrated in the movement. We were seen as bodies that, you know, helped convey the message that, you know, women needed the right to vote. But as you pointed out, it wasn't until 1965 that black women's rights to vote were secured. And when we think about now with immigrant women, people who are, you know, speak other languages, I think about how slow progress has been, even with all of this pushing. And I think, you know, it's so critical that we're having this conversation, and I appreciate you having us here today, because I think about how much further we need to go for people with disabilities, even though we have, you know, the ADA, people who are immigrant status. There are so many folks who theoretically have the right to vote.
We need to go to a brief bottom of the hour break here for a CBS Newsman and a couple words from our sponsors. I want to talk about this more on the other side of the break. I have a little story I think you'll be interested to hear, Tabitha, and it goes right to your point. I think we'll talk about it after the break here. Let's do that. CBS News upcoming on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back. My guests are Sue Racanelli and Rachel Onuff and Tabitha Moore, all of them members of a special commission that is basically organizing and leading the celebrations and observances of in Vermont of the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. The official effective date of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was August 26th, 1920. Of course, tomorrow is August 26th, 2020. So here we are on the eve of this very important centennial. We were talking before the break about the general human push for equality. I think was we started to broaden into that theme, especially some remarks from one guest, Tabitha Moore. And I wanted to tell you a little story, actually, which came up some last week on the show. I had a little family-flavored version of the suffrage celebration because I've got several kinfolk, a couple of cousins and a niece were actually guests on the program, and they are all, as I am, descendants of a woman by the name of Betty Graham, my dad's aunt she was, and she was a leading and very militant suffragist in the period leading up to the passage of the 19th Amendment, arrested several times along with her sister Alice. Alice eventually sort of stepped away from the movement a little bit. Betty stayed with it. Betty went around lobbying in various states, was reportedly key to getting the one vote passage in New Jersey and the one vote passage in Tennessee, the final state to ratify the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. And so it's a sort of an extra exciting time for my family. And we celebrated that last week. I wanted to get the Vermont flavor of the suffrage celebration on today. And so that's why I recruited the three guests we have with us. But your discussion, Tabitha Moore, just before the break of this sort of common push for human equality reminded me of a big flaw in the picture, frankly, in 1920, and one in which I think my grand aunt acquiesced, and that was Alice Paul, the head of the National Women's Party, apparently had a strategy where she said we essentially have to leave African Americans by the side of the road if we are going to get enough, especially Southern politicians, to support suffrage and get this women's right to vote codified in the Constitution. Big compromise. One of these stories of, I think, of making big progress, but also very obviously having a lot more to do. What do you make of that?
Well, it's the lack of ability to recognize the intersectional nature of identity as a whole, but then in particular intersectional oppression. And like I think I was saying before the break, the 15th Amendment was about guaranteeing African Americans the right to vote, but particularly men. And then the 19th Amendment comes along, and that's for white women. And black women are kind of caught in this in-between world place where they support both but see themselves represented in neither. And then, you get to people, black feminist theory that's developing in the 50s, 60s, and through the 70s, into Audre Lorde, where they start to coin phrases like intersectionality to create visibility for these populations. What was different, though, for black and brown women was that they weren't just fighting for their own right to vote, but for other marginalized people or people with other marginalized identities, because we know what it's like to be left out. And when we leave anybody out, we're definitely not a full society. Ida B. Wells, there's so many black women for whom, the suffrage movement would not have been what it was had they not been pushing as well, knowing full well that they would never have the same right. They would never see that in their lifetime. And it's both heartbreaking and inspiring, to know that, my foremothers were fighting for people even though they weren't fighting for them back.
Rachel, and I want to focus a little bit on the history of kind of Vermont's role in suffrage, and I'm wondering, it seems as though a lot of the activity, activism was really centered on Washington. There were regular protests for a while outside of the White House when Woodrow Wilson was president. He eventually, I guess, came around on the subject after being cool to it at first of women's suffrage. And I'm wondering, were there Vermonters who traveled to Washington to participate in these actions, or and were there any demonstrations to speak of? How frequent and broad based were they in Vermont during that time?
Well, we know of one Vermont woman who would have been in D.C. And undoubtedly knew Alice and Betty Graham. That would be Lucy Daniels of Grafton, who was certainly the only suffragist that we would identify as militant in Vermont, in that she did go down. She was a silent sentinel. She was energized to join the movement because she was frustrated after her state rep voted against legislation that would have allowed women to vote in municipal elections in Vermont. He voted against it, and in retaliation, she refused to pay her property taxes, saying, "Well, you're not representing my views. I'm not going to participate in this system." And she wrote, had painted on the side of one of her buildings in Grafton, a square deal, "Votes for Women." It's an image widely circulating now. You've probably seen it.
Yeah.
Vermont Historical Society has a copy. So that was her kind of way into the discussion is I pay property taxes and I can't vote. She was down in D.C. She was arrested. She also went to Boston, where I know Betty Graham was, to protest Wilson when he came back from Europe. So she was she's our most active one that we know of in that way.
Fascinating. Of course, that idea of no taxation without representation definitely precedes the even this period of our history. It goes all the way back to the American Revolution. But
it should resonate with all Americans. Absolutely.
For sure. And of course, in her case, maybe the slogan could have been amended slightly to say no taxation without participation. So. Mm-hmm. Which is, along the same lines, it seems, but, that is fascinating. And you said there was a march in Montpelier, 400, women, I gather mostly women, showed up to participate. Were there any significant in Vermont negative reactions by men, for instance, or just, I'll stop there.
Yeah. I mean, by men and by women. I mean, the antis were, those who were against suffrage for women were men and women, and the most organized group I know of was in Burlington, which actually had they identified themselves as the Anti-Suffragist Society, they were concerned that it would for all sorts of reasons, including that it might sully a woman's reputation to be mixing with politics, which is seen as such a nasty business. Of course, the other approach from the suffragist side was, we can elevate this. And people like Annette Parmalee talked about, their strategy was to argue for, well, women, we're more responsible and we care more and we are equal citizens and we will do well by our municipalities and our state and our country if we're given the franchise. So there were kind of different tacks to it, but there was absolutely, resistance to it, and as Tabitha said, but the governor was primarily concerned that that women would be, because there was some definitely connection between the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the WCPU, and the suffragist movement, and that if women got the vote, they would vote out any wet politicians. Would be against his business and personal interests.
Yeah, that's that is interesting how those two trends in politics were interwoven to some extent back in those days. And now I've got, actually, we have a listener who's calling in. Let's check in with Michelle from Plainfield. Good morning, Michelle.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to add something to the historical record, which is that after the Civil War, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was an early women's rights person, and Susan B. Anthony, they assumed that when African Americans got the right to vote, women would also get the right to vote, and they were shocked that women were not included in the amendment that gave African Americans the right to vote. So that really started the women's movement. They just assumed, oh, the franchise, we're going to get it. When, you know, they've been fighting as abolitionists all these years. And so I just want to add that.
Very interesting. Thank you for the call, Michelle. Tabitha Moore, does that ring a bell with your reading of history?
I could not really hear the caller. If you could report what they said, that would be great.
Yeah, basically talking about Elizabeth Cady Stanton and how at the very root of the, if I got this right now, if I got it wrong, Michelle, please call back and straighten me out. But I think what you were saying was that at the very root of the suffrage movement, really dating back into the post-Civil War period in the 19th century, there was a lot of sentiment for universal suffrage, that was going to be a theme that would extend to basically all people. And, it ended up being narrowed down, of course, as we mentioned, right at the culminating moments there in the 19 teens and up to 1920, when it was determined that if the suffrage movement was going to persuade, especially reluctant white male politicians, and apparently especially from the South, that they needed to basically jettison people of color. And one of my kinfolk, Pam Swing, was on the air with us last week, as I mentioned, and talking about my great aunt Betty Graham, and Pam described that whole scenario as unfortunate. And sure enough, I think most people would agree these days that was a tough sacrifice on the part of the people who were, and it's kind of bizarre, but I mean, it seems to be progress is oftentimes two steps forward and one step back, or one step forward and two steps back, depending on how you count them. I don't know. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, people will often start out saying, oh yeah, we're for everyone. But when they see that, what their ultimate goal is, which was for her, for people who look like her to gain the right, they'll often sacrifice people along the way. And that's one of the things that we just cannot happen, because we end up in situations like we're in right now.
That is the story. It seems to be an old one. And I have a couple of emails from folks who have been sending in notes to me and ask various questions they're interested in having answered here. And let's see if I can. Actually, we've already had an answer to that one question about did any Vermonters picket the White House and participate in those actions in Washington? And the answer is yes, at least. Rachel Onuf, Lucy, refresh me on her last name.
Daniels,
yeah, I knew I'd heard that name too. I guess I haven't come across it in my recent reading, but there's another, and that's fascinating to see how that was playing out as well in tiny little Vermont town of Grafton at the time. Here's a question from Sandy Dooley: how soon after the 19th Amendment did Vermont women run for and get elected to the state House of Representatives or Senate? Rachel, do you know that one?
Yeah, right away. Edna Beard of Orange, who had been a teacher and had been, I believe she was the town clerk, she's definitely the town treasurer. She ran and was the first woman in the House of Representatives, and then next election she was elected to the Senate. So she was the first legislator, and did not have a long tenure. She went back to being the town treasurer after a couple of terms, but she did it, and it was by the few accounts we have, it was tough, at least initially, that there was ridiculous behavior about who would be her seatmate in the House. Someone had to sit next to the girl. I think we've come a long way. And there was an article in VT Digger today that noted that Vermont is fifth in the United States for the proportion of women in the legislature. We're a little over 40% of our representatives in the House and in the Senate are women. And the national average is around 29%. Shout out to the Vermont State Curator's Office because they track these things for us.
Very, very interesting. One thing that has struck me about the legislature over recent years, and I covered the legislature for a long time for the Associated Press before taking this radio gig, and it seems as though, even though I don't think women have ever been an outright majority in the legislature, they certainly have taken leadership roles. I think of course, Mitzi Johnson is our second female speaker. It looks like Becca Vallance is going to be the president of pro tem of the Senate. She's been majority leader. We had the two sisters as chairs of the Jane Kitchell and Kitty Toll. There we go. Come on, Dave, bring that list forward. Jane Kitchell and Kitty Toll as chairs of the appropriations committees in the House and Senate, Senate and House, respectively, Jane Kitchell in the Senate and Kitty Toll in the House. Very powerful positions. You're chair of appropriations. You are writing the state budget, and that's kind of amazing when you think about how women really have, even still a minority in the Vermont legislature, have risen to the top in many respects.
Yeah,
what do you think about that? Let me ask actually.
Congratulate ourselves for that. But one thing to bear in mind, those are all white women, and we still have a long way to go in terms of in making it more possible and accessible for women of color to get into the legislature and to thrive there and to achieve leadership roles. Another place where Vermont's really, I think, lagging behind is another statistic. Since 1778, we've elected 296 statewide officers, and 10 have been women. And, of course,
that's
we're
a pretty small number.
All aware that Vermont and Mississippi are the only states that have never sent a woman to Congress in D.C. So, and Sue, I'm curious if the League of Women Voters, if you all target and Tabitha, you too at the NAACP, if you all target like specific goals for trying to move the ball forward, and might say, okay, we're doing okay in the legislature, but we need to really work on some of these elected positions and getting more representation there, or we've got to get somebody in the U.S. Capitol.
Let's ask Tabitha first. What do you make of that, Tabitha?
We certainly are trying to get more people into office. I think one of the things that gave me hope was when Christine Hallquist was the Democratic front runner for governor here in Vermont a couple years ago. She may not be black, but like I said, I think our freedom is inextricably connected. So I was very proud to see that progress here in our state. At the same time, the NAACP, the Rutland area branch, and the Windham branch are working together right now to develop a political preparation and leadership training for black and brown people in Vermont, all types of brown folks, to be able to feel comfortable and confident going into office. But yes, that is one thing that we are trying to do is target more, but people are afraid. They see what happens here. They see what happened to Kaya Morris. They see what happens to any of us who speak out, and the lack of accountability
you know, from the government, and, you know, there's starting to be more with the community. But one of the things that we have to do to clear the way is make sure that they will be protected, because it is not the same thing when you're black and brown and you run for office here in Vermont. And so we need to both prepare the people to be able to handle it and prepare the community to be able to receive it and accept the amazing skills that will come when we become more diverse.
I'm going to offer a counter theory here, just for and whoever wants to comment is welcome, especially in relation to our tiny Washington delegation. I mean, most other states have many more members of the U.S. House than we do. We only have two U.S. senators, so we have three seats in Washington, basically. And there is an amazingly powerful strength of incumbency in these seats for members of the Senate and U.S. House nationwide. Pat Leahy was elected to the U.S. Senate from Vermont in 1974, before a lot of us were born. Bernie Sanders has held one of the three seats since 1990 now. That's a quarter there. That's 30 years. Peter Welch was elected in 2006 to the U.S. House. Interestingly, I think the two strongest female candidates for Congress in the last 25 years ago, I would say Susan Sweetser and Martha Rainville were two female candidates who really had a chance of winning the U.S. House seat. Both were Republicans in an increasingly Democratic state. Is some of this just anomaly? What do you think about that, Sue Racanelli?
Well, I think that we are very comfortable with the people that have been elected, and they do a good job for Vermont. But our time will come, and things will change. The country is changing, and Vermont will change as well.
What do you think, Tabitha Moore?
I would certainly agree with the sentiment that in Vermont, you know, we kind of have this idea that if it's not broke, don't fix it. But recognizing what's broke is also predicated upon recognizing injustice, systemic injustice. So I think that as Vermont starts to recognize the value of diversity in office, we're going to see more.
Going to see more diversity. Well, let's bring it on. That's a... We have more work to do. I want to thank my three guests, Rachel Onuff, Tabitha Moore, Sue Racanelli, very much for joining us this morning. Excellent conversation, the three of you, and I wish you luck with your celebrations tomorrow.
David, can I have a quick minute to tell your guests what's going on? I did forget to mention a very important thing happening tomorrow.
Yes.
So tomorrow, between 11 and 3, the Vermont Suffrage Centennial Alliance has invited the public to commemorate the passage of the 19th Amendment by gathering in public spaces around towns in Vermont. And so we have different people in Barrie, Bennington, Burlington, Montpelier, Norwich, St. Albans, St. Johnsbury, Winooski, Worcester, and these folks are going to come. They're going to wear 1920s hats, Votes for Women sashes, and carrying nonpartisan, nonpolitical signs, engaging in social distancing, and wearing masks, face coverings. And they will be engaging passerbys on the importance of voting. And that is happening tomorrow. So just drop in at any time between 11 and 3. Burlington will
have a
variety of speakers as well.
All righty. Thank you so much. I got to go.
Thank you.
The three of you have been excellent. We'll call it a day on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. Stay tuned for the governor and other top state officials talking about the COVID-19 crisis.